UNC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Hi, this is Brian from Hellshock. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Party on, Vancouver.
There's only one way that old clunker is going to make you feel good again. Donate it to Bullying Canada. Check this out. Free towing or pickup of your old vehicle, a tax-deductible receipt, and a super easy process. Online at bullyingcanada.ca. Get rid of that old vehicle and feel good about supporting real solutions for change in your community. Donate your old or used vehicle to Bullying Canada today. Full details online at bullyingcanada.ca.
Hey, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Hunkamina-speaking Musqueam people. My name is Josh Gabardoyan. In the next hour, you're going to hear a bonus episode from Season 2 of CITR Docs. It's a documentary I originally produced for CIVL Radio out of Abbotsford. They broadcast on 101.7 FM. It's a story about spying and surveillance, and it originally aired during the summer as part of the CIVL mini-school funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. I also want to thank Sam Fenn from the podcast Cited for his really helpful comments and editing pointers on this piece. It's titled The Spy Store. It's about the experience of watching others when they don't know you're watching. Hope you like it. When I call up the spy store, I tell them I'm making a radio piece about security and safety in today's day and age, which isn't exactly the truth. I ask the clerk on the phone if I can speak to the owner. I can answer any questions you might have, says the man on the phone. Oh, I say. Well, I was wondering if someone from the spy store might be available for an interview. The clerk takes a second to pause. I can tell you right now, they're not going to be interested, he says. Why is that? I ask. Because it's the spy store, he replies. This answer seems at once perfectly reasonable and absolutely ridiculous. One thing that can be said about the internet is that it's turned us all into spies. But even offline, most of us have spent a fair bit of time spying on others. We listen in on conversations at the table next to us when we're out for dinner. We people watch on the bus and we swap secrets behind closed doors. We spy all the time, but very rarely do any of us gear up to do it. We might have our own little tricks and strategies, but spying is mostly a casual affair. The Spy Store is on the corner of Broadway and Burrard, and according to the website, it's one of the four storefronts of the largest spy retailer in North America. Announcing yourself as a spy store seems counterintuitive. The storefront is modest, with big barred windows and an oversized sign. If you look into the windows of the storefront, the wood paneling and the gray carpets make it look as if it could pass for a children's shoe store. Inside, they sell fake cameras and cameras disguised as Pepsi cans, night vision goggles, and kits for finding out if your spouse is cheating on you. Their display case holds bear spray, handcuffs, and steel gloves, and it all looks very suspiciously like some kind of front. The spy store keeps their lights on late into the night, and every time I pass the store, I wonder how they've managed to stay open all these years. They have a 10-minute browsing maximum policy that has incited scorn on their Yelp page, where they sit at a solid 1.9 stars out of 5. The more generous Yelp reviews describe the salespeople at the store as unbelievably rude, dismissive, and just plain old jerks. They have an online store, but that doesn't stop people from going to the Burrard location, where there are reports of clerks playing video games and shooing customers away when they ask too many questions. Yet despite all this, the spy store has been there since 1999, catering to all of our spy needs. When I was in the second grade, I was deeply committed to being a spy. I had a copy of the Osborne Spy Guidebook. It was an instructive, practical guide to spying. I learned how to crack codes and how to distinguish clues from red herrings. But there was also a lot of Boy Scout tricks, mostly having to do with twig structures and big leaves. There weren't many big leaves in the city where I grew up, but there was plenty to spy on. I peered out from the bushes at my grandmother, coming into her apartment, and perched on the stairs watching my dad try to program the VCR. My mom was a teacher at my elementary school, so I spent early mornings before class wandering the halls, gaining illicit access to classrooms and janitors' closets. In the early morning, I would peer out from corners to spy on teachers completely alone, arranging pencils in a neat line, or placing picture books in a row against the blackboard wall. Spying seemed like a respectable career path, on par with being an astronaut or a doctor that only treated horses. I would take my spy briefcase, black, leather, covert, and make my way to work. At lunch, I would take a break from spying and unpack a ham sandwich. Spying was slick and clean. Spies wore gloves and hung their trench coats up on racks. I would fill my briefcase with all kinds of gadgets. I had a magnifying glass for identifying greasy fingerprints, a telescope for observing a secret handshake off in the distance, a pair of spy sunglasses for keeping harsh rays off my sensitive telescope eyes. Spying was dangerous but rarely lethal, which suited me well. I wonder what it would be like if I had continued down that career path, if I hadn't given up on the dream. I remember the feeling of spying, the feeling of looking at someone as they do an ordinary, boring task that they think they're doing completely unobserved. It's a moment where you get to see the world that happens behind your back, even if what happens is incredibly dull. I wanted to know what it was about the experience of spying that had attracted me to it in the first place. I talked with my friend Britt Bachman about her time as a spy. After my call with the spy store, I had been asking around to try and find someone who had first-hand spying experience as an adult. Something that's hard to find, which makes sense seeing that most spies try and keep that stuff hidden. Britt was less shy. Her spying specialty is breakups. She has a discreet black camera to record them. And contrary to what the Osborne Spy Guidebook suggested, she didn't wear a fake disguise, not even a mustache. If we could categorize the different kinds of spying, Brits would be a kind of watching for watching's sake.
I was living in Paris for an exchange at a fine arts academy there, and I was really lonely. I didn't have a lot to do. I wasn't doing that well in my courses because everyone was pretty cold to talk to. I was having a really hard time connecting with people, and I was doing a lot of walking around Paris, trying to figure out the different neighborhoods. And I started following people just for fun. At first, it was just following people who I thought were attractive, not necessarily like sexually attractive, but maybe they had great clothing, or I liked what book they were reading in a park and that sort of thing. And yeah, that's how I started following people.
How long would you follow them for?
I would set parameters on it. So sometimes I just had a very limited amount of time. So I'd say, okay, I'm going to follow someone for 1 hour or 30 minutes or something to that effect. Or sometimes it would be like, I'm going to follow someone until they get food. So I'd set these little rules for myself that I would just follow people as long as a certain amount of time had passed or they had done something. And in that time, I started to take photos of them as well so that I could create drawing series based off their movements and their habits. I saw a lot of weird things. People treat each other very weird. One of the first videos that I ever took, I was spying from my bedroom, and I had this view into some offices of the Ministry of Finance in the 16e arrondissement, and there was a woman who would always stay late, and she was on the phone, and I just had my camera out, and I was taking some photos, and as I was recording her, she put the phone down and then just burst into tears. It was obviously just a really stressful conversation for her, and there was somebody else in the office, but I couldn't see the person because they were behind a pillar. But she started describing something to this person while crying. And that was also one of the first times that it occurred to me that what I was doing or what I had wanted to do in recording people was maybe like taboo or dirty or wrong. I definitely got the sense like I was seeing something that I was really not supposed to be seeing.
And did it keep being that way? Did it keep feeling, I don't know, unethical?
Definitely depends on the situation. When I was in Paris, I definitely felt kind of a sense of entitlement, perhaps, or maybe not entitlement, but something similar that I felt as if it was my right to capture these images, because it was the way that I was connecting to the people around me, albeit like unconventionally. And there's definitely better ways to connect with people than to follow them and photograph them and draw them. But it was something that I kind of needed to keep myself grounded and sane, because I was quite lonely. But then coming back to Canada, it felt a lot. I mean, spying is a privilege, and I did feel increasingly gross about it. I do have a lot of appreciation and respect for the people that I've spied on, which it might not seem like it, but I'm paying very close attention to the way they move and just really closely observing everything about them. And I do develop a fondness, a love of a certain sense. I do feel like an amount of bonding or intimacy with that. I realize it's completely one-sided because these people have no idea who I am, but I do cherish everyone that I've taken a photo of.
Do you feel that who you've chosen to spy on has changed since that first kind of attraction?
Yes. Or, well, I'm less interested in people my own age, because before, when I lived in Paris, a lot of the people I were following were people that seemed to be around the same age as me, and that was just a direct result of me being lonely, I think, and seeking community and not knowing how to go about it. But now I'm definitely more interested in people who are a lot older and a lot younger. And when it comes to like children, like it'll only ever be like friends' children or something, you know. So there's a lot more like ethics around it now as well. Documenting people like off the street is a very different type of situation. So yeah, I think about it a lot more now.
Even with the kind of ethical issue, you haven't stopped though.
No, I still take photos of strangers a lot. I ride a lot of public transit. That's like prime photo taking zone. And yeah, I think I do it less now because I'm a bit busier, but it's always on my mind. And I see something almost every day that I wish I had my camera for and usually don't. So yeah, the urge has not stopped.
What about when you see people, you describe this kind of love, but what about if you see people doing something that's completely unsavory or just negative? What then?
I think that it's still quite loving, because I have recorded people, you know, shooting up or urinating. Actually, I have like a whole series with my friend Corey just peeing behind garbage bins that I'm sure she loves I just mentioned on this. But I do still find like such beauty in that, because that is a personal choice that's being made by a human in a moment. And I think that free will, that's part of what I like, why I like spying as opposed to talking and addressing people directly, is that I like to see what people do with their free will, with the choices they make, which roads they'll turn down, which sides of the street they'll walk on. And I think that's part of that's aspects of their personality that I'm paying attention to that maybe they're not even paying attention to.
Anything else to add? Any other weird experiences that you saw?
I saw you biking on the 99 and took a photo of you, but you knew that already.
That was kind of creepy.
Exactly.
Brit spying relies on gadgets, recorders, documentation, the thrill of getting it all on tape. I want to investigate the spy store, and I need some real spy gear. So I decide to take a trip to the store as a recon mission. I have my eye on the MemoQ recording pen, voice-activated recording in a discreet, fully functional ballpoint pen. It goes for $169, according to their website. As I walk closer, I tell myself this is a test for the spies at the spy store. A test to see if they can catch me spying. I feel my palms get sweaty. It's spy versus spy. They're the professionals, and this is my first case. I look down at my shirt pocket where I have my phone recording a voice memo.
Okay, I'm going in now to the spy store.
My plan is not to make up any far-fetched stories. I'm just an ordinary customer coming in to buy a $169 recording pen. An ordinary customer would never tell the spy store what they were spying on, I tell myself. To blurt it out would look suspicious. So I have no backstory. I look down at my shirt pocket, paranoid. Whistling is my defense against the panic. They know for sure. They can smell it on me, and when they find out I'm recording, who knows what will happen. I look around nervously and nonchalantly, aware that the clock on my browsing time is ticking. On the other end of the room, two men sit at big computer desk chairs, the leather kind that squeak when you kick back.
How does the Memo Q audio pen hold up?
Hold up?
Yeah, is the recording quality okay?
Yeah. The recording quality on all of those is alright. Especially if it's like for a meeting or something, or you're leaving it in a room about this size. Like, I could have it pretty much anywhere in this room and pick up.
It would pick up.
Yeah. Corporate espionage, spying on the big meeting. The clerk is young, in his 20s, and the older man, who looks like he comes from a military background, sits silently at the chair. There's a big red sale tag on the Memo Q pen.
And you have a sale on this one. $169.
Standard price now. Just left it on there.
The sale sticker is just a ruse. That is the actual price. There's no sale. It's a spy sale.
Do you guys take Visa?
Yeah.
He's surprised when I asked to buy the pen. Surprised anybody would buy a pen for $169.
Are you back for that, or?
No, I'll just start here. Great dog.
I peer over the counter and catch sight of a dog flashing its teeth at me. The dog is poised next to the military man in his chair. It's a black dog with pointy ears, a DDR German Shepherd. Purebred work dog, popular with military and police forces. It's named after its home country, the Deutschland Democratic Republic, East Germany. If spy movies have taught me anything, these are the bad guys.
Just bought $169 recording pen from the spy store.
Leaving the spy store, I decide the next step is a full-on stakeout. But first, I ask my roommate Ben about his snooping experience, using it as an opportunity to test out my newly purchased spy pen.
How long had it been that you had been broken up?
So at that point, I think we'd been broken up for like 3 months or 4 months-ish.
Ben spying is a type of relationship spying. Spying on someone when you already know what you're going to find out.
But the thing with this breakup was that, like, we'd been dating for a couple of years, and then she, like, immediately, like, basically, like, the next week, like, started dating this other dude who was, like, her best friend that I always knew, that we hung out with a lot and stuff, which, like, messed me up. But, now, like, I can't blame her for that. It's, like, fine. They're still together. Like, they have a really nice relationship.
Right.
And, like, that's cool. But at that time when I was, like, super jealous about it, yeah. Well, that's when I was, like, yeah, like, used the internet to make myself more miserable, I think. Like, not, maybe not consciously, but yeah. So, yeah, that's when, like, this thing that I did happen.
And then you were keeping tabs on it from, like, basically that first week because she got in this relationship so quick.
Yeah, well, I don't remember. I think I blocked her. After a certain point, we were like, okay, it's obviously not healthy for us to, like, have access to each other's life. So I think I blocked her, which gave me the control then. Yeah. And then, this was on Facebook. And then, but then what happened was I went to this party. It was one of these, like, dance parties where you just get, like, very drunk and stay until, like, 7 in the morning. And at, like, 7 in the morning, I biked home in the rain. And I was just feeling so tired and, like, so depleted. And, like, the party had been really fun, but it was just, like, at a certain point, it's like, okay, it's time to go home. And I just felt so depleted. And I got home, And then I was just, I don't know, opened up the Facebook, and then I was like, well, let's see, like, what she's doing, whatever. And I, like, for some reason, unblocked her. And then saw, what I actually saw was there that she had, like, an ad. She'd posted a thing that was like, I'm subletting my room for a few weeks. I'm, like, going on a trip to Europe or whatever. Does anyone want to sublet my room? And then I was, like, immediately realized, like, oh, she's, like, going on this trip with her boyfriend, which was a trip that I had always wanted to take with her, and we talked about, like, going to Europe a lot, but we never really got it together, probably because we weren't really meant to be dating anymore. And then, so, I found out that she went on this trip to Europe with her dude, and then that made me really upset. For some reason, I didn't stop there. I, like, looked through her photos. I saw, like, all these new pictures of her and the guy and, like, all their friends, like, having a great time, and I don't know, for some reason my reaction when I was, like, when I was doing this was not, like, I was really angry, and I didn't really have the right to be, and I kind of knew that also, that I was just essentially being a jealous creep. So the most honest response that I could come up with was to put these little stickers on the photos.
Like, those are big emoji stickers?
Yeah, like, the little virtual stickers of, like, little characters. So I had this, like, I had this one set of stickers that I used a lot for a while because I felt like I really related to all of them, which is, they're called Oakley in Action. It's, like, this little green owl who's very cute, and he just, like, he does a lot of, like, funny stuff, like, little dances, and, like, he's got one where he's like, I quit! he's got, like, a lot of attitude. Anyway, so I ended up posting some stickers on, like, all these photos of her and her boyfriend. I was, like, probably insanely drunk at 7 a.m. or something. And then, I posted a sticker of, like, the owl, like, reading a book propped open on his lap. And then I think I posted another sticker of him doing this little dance where he's, like, shaking his tail feathers. And this other one, where he's, like, looking through binoculars, like, at something, and, like, kind of, like, amazed at what he's looking at. And then I just, like, I don't know, then I just kind of closed my computer and, like, tried to go to sleep. And I remember I was, like, so anxious because I felt like that was a really crazy thing to do that I, like, couldn't get to sleep for a while. But in the end, I did fall asleep. And then in the morning, of course, I was, like, whoa, what did I do?
Did you try to delete them?
I think I didn't delete them. I think what happened is I looked at them and no one had reacted to them at all, which felt weird, but nothing had really happened. So I didn't delete them because I felt like I was like, oh, it felt like honest at the time. And also like, she's obviously seen them now. It's like noon. Like deleting them wouldn't really serve much of a function. And then I think an hour later or so, I realized that she'd unfriended me.
But you had like committed to, like, stalking her profile, but also, like, being seen as well.
Yeah. I think it was, like, this kind of drastic, like, cry for sympathy kind of thing. It wasn't cool. The thing that wasn't cool about it was then, like, later that day, we texted. We ended up texting about it, and she said that it had scared her, which, I can understand, you know? It's kind of psychotic. She's like, I felt like, you were psychotic, like, posting stickers on my photos at 7 a.m. And I was like, yeah, sorry, I was feeling really bad. And, like, I think we actually, like, had a really good talk after that, which was interesting, and ended up resolving some things. And, like, gradually, like, of course, now I feel like we're on okay terms.
And then, like, in terms of looking at people's profiles, I mean, that's, like, almost, like, standard fare now with relationships.
Yeah.
Like, when you're leading up to a relationship and then also, like, post-relationship.
Yeah.
It's, like, almost hard to imagine a relationship that wouldn't involve that.
Yeah, for sure. I guess what it was, I think that she didn't expect me to be looking at her photos because we'd agreed to not be in contact on the internet, that it was better, but then it was me, I had unblocked her, so that allowed me, like, access or whatever, so it was kind of like I was going against what we'd agreed, but really it was like, I was only hurting myself.
Right, what do you remember about the experience of looking through those photos?
I just felt like I was looking at someone who was in the complete opposite place that I was, where I was like, and of course this is all a projection, but I was like, I'm miserable, like, I'm heartbroken, I've lost the person that I thought was, like, my person, and now I'm looking at her being with this new person and looking extremely happy and going on trips to Europe together. It's like a fantasy, but a negative fantasy or something. It's kind of like a nightmare. It was like, yeah, I felt like it was kind of a nightmare to me. I felt like a spy, I guess, because it was like I was looking at something I knew I shouldn't be looking at because it wasn't good for me, but it totally was public information. I wasn't hacking her. I was just like, here's like an area of the world that I shouldn't be looking at right now for myself, and like I am looking at it, and I'm masochistically interacting with it or something. It seems ridiculous objectively, you know? Like, oh, it's a guy who's like, who wants something he doesn't have, and he can't come to terms with the fact that he doesn't have that. When really it's like, okay, I needed to make some changes in my life to get the things, to get happiness, like, back, kind of. And instead I was just looking at someone else's happiness and, like, letting it torture me, kind of.
Why do you think that you looked at them in the first place?
It's a good question. I don't know. I don't know. That's something I'd like to figure out, is why do people do stuff that they know that it isn't good for them? I feel like we do little things like that all the time, right? I think it being more in control of that impulse, whatever it is, would probably make you a happier person.
Part of me is happy I never continued as a spy. In watching, we experience the gestures and the intimacy of another human. But the more we watch, the more we step outside of ourselves. We start watching those moments through frosted glass. Is spying all about testing the limits of loneliness? Ben's story is a lament of a former spy, but I have a stakeout to do, and so I need some spying advice from an expert.
My name is Mark Cusick. I'm a private investigator with Cusick & Cusick Private Investigators.
Mark and his wife Ilona run Cusick & Cusick together. Most of their business is insurance companies who hire them to capture video of people trying to commit insurance fraud. But they also do a fair bit of corporate espionage and, of course, private clients. Mark prefers the missing person cases, but husbands and wives trying to find out if somebody is cheating on them is more typical. How do you describe the experience of surveillance, kind of for you personally? How do you find it?
I mean, it's like being a cook. You have to do your prep work, know where you're going, know the area that you're doing surveillance on, know the roads in and out, know a little bit history about the subject that you're doing surveillance. Is there a particular time when this person is leaving or going? And certainly it's long hours. You are put into a situation where you could be sitting in a vehicle for 7, 8, 10 hours. Maybe nothing happens, or you could be there for an hour, and then all of a sudden you're driving all over the Lower Mainland. You're hoping that you don't lose this person because you're only doing a one-man surveillance. So it has its ups and downs for sure. With the private sector, there's many times that we've been all over the place in terms of following someone who is supposedly having an affair or not having an affair. We've traveled up to Whistler. We've had our investigators skiing behind a couple that were supposedly together. And in this particular case, it was a lady from the States. Her husband hired us from somewhere in California. She came up here to Whistler to go skiing with her mother and her younger children, and it turns out it was the ski instructor that traveled with them was the one that she was having the affair with. So it was a case of going all over the place to obtain a very small amount of video.
Mark's stories were cheering me up. I can imagine the snowsuit I'll wear for spy skiing. Mark says that for a stakeout, the trick is being prepared.
The number one rule is doing your homework. Doing a an overview of the area that you're doing surveillance, what the area looks like. You have to sort of get yourself in there at an early hour, sort of have this sort of easy way to just put yourself there so you don't attract a lot of attention. And I guess one of the other things is anticipation. When a person leaves, when to start your car up so you're not driving directly behind that person. You have to have timing, I guess, like a comedian or an actor. You have to develop sort of a calmness. I mean, if you think about it, when you drive your car on a daily basis, you really don't pay much attention to what's behind you. Sure, you look in your rearview mirror if you're going to make a lane change, you check traffic, but you're not sort of focusing on what's behind you. People that usually do that are surveillance conscious. And have perhaps a history of maybe insurance claims or being followed, or maybe they have a lifestyle that makes them think that people are following them.
If anyone is going to have a lifestyle like that, it was going to be the clerks at the spy store. Surrounded by spy stuff all the time, I am expecting nothing less than complete paranoia. I don't have a car myself, so I team up with my friend and spy associate, Liam, to stage the operation. He owns a 1989 Toyota pickup. I head to his place with my trusty spy pen. I am raring to go. Liam is feeling more contemplative.
Well, I mean, now that the economy is all based on aesthetics and cosmology of, like, a certain class they're trying to sell to you, there's a lot of just speculative... I don't know, there's a lot of money in
it. Takes us a while to leave the house. All the way to the spy store, Liam talks about the cage of masculinity.
But that kind of changed my view, where I was like, maybe it's just hard to fall in love, actually.
Right,
maybe
right.
It's really like, this is something I'm not really capable of.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. No, absolutely.
And that really disturbed me, when I was like, what if I'm not capable of this?
I take solace in the fact that for our stakeout, we have the cover of Midday Traffic.
Woo-wee!
Oh, boy.
Down one way, be careful, eh?
Yeah.
Great. This is already spy. We're going down the one way. This is it's all already covered. We've already blown the cover, basically.
We park outside the spy store. It's pay parking, so we have to keep getting out to fill the meter.
I don't have any change, Liam. I need to get
some of this guy.
But there we are, spying on the spy store.
Yeah.
We get to the long, hard task of a stakeout operation.
Let's give an initial observation.
I can't see anyone in there.
12:56. The lights are on.
The lights are on. The open sign is blinking. Haven't seen anyone go in there yet.
No.
Can't really see any people in there.
This is the third type of spying. Spying on a hunch.
The banner is on.
The banner is on.
Something about pepper spray.
Pepper spray's on sale today. And then there's a empty storefront beside them, which is pretty suspicious. Could be anything in there.
Yeah, that's pretty weird.
And then there's an oxygen yoga place. One over from that. I love my life is the title on the sign of that one. Oxygen yoga and fitness.
Oh, man. I love the idea of someone doing yoga with, like, an oxygen tank and, like, that medical... medical oxygen tank with them.
Just clunking around.
We keep a lookout for anyone entering or exiting the store.
Also, there's a dog over there. I don't know if that's the dog you're talking about. It does have pointy ears.
Is it a... Oh, yeah, it's way bigger.
Yeah.
That's like a racing dog or something.
That's not a spy dog.
That's built for racing.
Oh, man. Sometimes I wish I was built for stuff.
Yeah. Built for nothing, man.
Built to be a beta. My memoir. God, I wish I had more purpose.
It's been nearly an hour. Liam chews Nicorette gum. I investigate his glove box and find a pair of spy sunglasses, which feels like a good sign. As a mix of excitement and paranoia builds, it's like I'm a kid all over again.
Neocolonialism is also propagated by this moral authoritarianism that comes from people in Western academic circles or whatever.
Yeah. Oh, somebody's in the oxygen yoga and fitness place.
Oh, that is the first
sighting
in any of those stores. She's ringing the sign in. Looks like they're closing it. Don't know what they're doing for lunch break. Probably getting some of the finest oxygen. Sitting there, and it's really hard to form a praxis for love.
Right. You know? So there's a guy in a red shirt that walked in, and I see him there now at the counter looking through the glass, the display cases.
And that's like the travesty of like the
this guy is looking into the spy store. He's going in. It looks like he's going in a little bit like a joke. He's going in with his girlfriend. They were walking by it and then they stopped. Oh, and now they're coming out.
Oh, that was quick.
Okay, this is the guy coming out.
That guy?
The guy that just came out. I think he might be the boss.
Finally, we have some action.
Maybe not. Is he coming over here?
A man with a Captain America shirt exits the store. I recognize him from my first visit.
I'm kind of freaked out. Look at that guy.
Oh, he's beelining across the street.
Yeah.
I'm gonna put away my phone. Is he gonna turn? No, he's going the other direction. Okay. Maybe he's just going to the Starbucks.
I don't want to f*** that guy. That guy looks serious.
He has a Captain America shirt on.
He does, yeah. And he's tall.
He's pretty burly. He's got a pair of spy sunglasses, too.
Yeah, and he walks like a man, an alpha man.
I decide to follow the Captain America man to find where he's going. I get out of the car and pursue him on foot. He crosses down Burrard Street, and I struggle to make the light. I shuffle my legs as if I'm speed walking, but trying my best to look casual. At some point, he ducks into a store or takes a cross street, and I lose him pretty quickly. So I decide to go into Burrard Street Liquor, not a half block away from the spy store, to ask some questions.
What do you guys know about that spy store up there? Like, it's been there for a while.
The spy store?
Yeah, the one on your kitty corner there.
And I'm not even very familiar with this area. Okay. I've only been here for like 6 months. Do you guys know much about the spy store?
I didn't even know there was a spy store.
The spy store on Broadway and Burrard?
Spy store at Broadway and Burrard.
Yeah.
Like right here.
Yeah.
Back at the car, I tell Liam that the liquor store didn't have any intel. Liam's inner turmoil hasn't gone anywhere since I left. He goes back to musing on Vancouver's cultural ecosphere.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think if there wasn't, like, a housing crisis, there wouldn't be this huge drive for people to, like... Oh, are we getting a ticket?
Really?
A bylaw officer steps up to the car.
Just put it in the side street. It's rush hour right now.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Pushed away by the gentle wave of bureaucracy, we pull the car around the block to the spy store's back entrance. This is the more spy-y entrance anyways, I tell myself.
Is that all? That's all no parking back there.
Yeah, it doesn't look like
there's anything. Who would think that spying is so much about getting a good parking spot?
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, a city like this, man, jeez. Can't imagine what it'd be like in New York.
Liam goes to scout out the back entrance next to the spy store's official parking spot.
Okay, Liam's going to check out the back of the spy store now. He's trying to look really casual. Turn it over. Lost sight of him. He's coming back now.
So there's a sign over there that says spy store parking. No parking spot. It's like the other one's like balloon parking, and then there's a car like this, and then it says spy store, and there's like about like 3 square feet of concrete. So I looked in the store, and the guy's just in like the back right-hand corner.
There's just one guy in there?
One guy, yeah.
The big Captain America guy?
I couldn't tell if it was him. It might have been someone else. Maybe,
really?
Maybe he's in the back or something.
Aside from parking, nothing much is happening back here. Spying is boring, and Liam is tired of his Nicorette. We decide it might be time to break the 10-minute browsing policy.
Are we going
to
lock this?
Yeah.
I give the pen to Liam because I figure it'll be less suspicious than me holding on to it.
Oh, is it pushed down?
And yep, be pushed down. Cool. All right. Hello. So we are heading around the back of the spy store right now.
Okay, you can put it on your
The two of us walk in together and promptly drop our eyes to look at the display cases. We're inside now. It's just us and Captain America Man behind the counter.
How you doing? All right. Just calling about baseball here. Just making sure you're not going to be on May 29th, right?
This was a little suspicious. Sports references are almost always a secret code. We hit the 5-minute mark on our browsing limit.
Fake security camera.
And then 10.
5-minute infidelity test.
And then 15.
What do you think the minute count is?
At minute 18, the browsing limit unenforced, we decide to call it a day. The spy store is a workshop of paranoia, and Liam is nervous about the parking.
I better go check on the truck.
Yeah. I don't know, what were your impressions from that?
That they did not care that we were in there, and if anything, they didn't want us in there.
Yeah, they would have just rather we weren't in there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the guy seemed like he was, like, intently playing some kind of video game. I think we won.
I think we won. I think we can call it a day.
But there was one final piece of the investigation that I needed to check out. I get on my bike early one morning, spy pen clipped my spandex shorts. I biked through my neighborhood and passed the spy store on Burrard. It was before it had opened, the silent spy ticker tape whirling as the city slept. I biked through the downtown core, spies on their way to work, briefcases in hand, through Stanley Park, where spy squirrels looked at me through the tree line, across the Lionsgate Bridge into North Van. I passed strip malls and suburban streets with neighborhood watch signs. I'm tracking a story I heard, kind of urban legend. My spy pilgrimage has led me to Marine Drive Road, to a mecca of spying. This block is where two spy stores once sat facing each other, a story of two competitors spying in perpetuity. The spy store, its North Van location, had won out in the end. Spy Inc. had closed down, and now it was in front of it, boarded up with only a spy sign left, blowing in the wind. I'm here to pay my respects, I think. I stand here a few minutes just to experience how dull it was, the ruins of a spy shop. Knocking out the competitors and leaving only destruction in its wake, the spy store is a titan of Western Canadian spy retail. I wish them well. I cycle back through North Vancouver, straight to the shoreline near the Lionsgate Bridge, and I stand by the water. I try to tell myself that spying is perverse, but that doesn't seem like the whole story. The experience of watching connects us with something beyond ourselves. In watching, we get to see what it is to be human in our most banal, adult forms. In spying, we gain access to our own moments of breakdown and fixation. When I was a kid, spying was about watching the boring, ordinary parts of being grown up. And at least some of the time, being an adult means being deeply, deeply lonely. The impulse towards spying is about understanding that dull, human experience of time passing. I crouch down by the water and put my spy pen to rest, sending it down with the current. For now, I've done all the spying I need to do. Today you heard the voices of writer and visual artist Britt Bachman and Ben Stevenson. Ben is the author of A Matter of Life and Death, or something, and his story today is adapted from his forthcoming novel. You also heard Mark Cusick of Cusick & Cusick, the employees of Burrard Liquor Store, and Liam Dolan, who plays in the band Mirepoix. Many thanks to Sam Fenn of Cited for his production help. You've been listening to The Spy Store on CITR 101.9 FM. That was a bonus episode from Season 2 of CITR Docs. It was produced by me, Josh Gabbert-Dwyall, as part of the CIVL Mini School. Thanks for tuning in.
All right, click.